Power 98.7.
In our market segment this week, we talked to Stephen Fancola, the CEO of EOH Holdings. Cyprus listed technology counters have had a hard few years in boring issues relating to corruption, dealing with public sector work, and also have had investors concerned about their high debt load. It's a theme of many corporate stories on the JSE over the past 2 years as the house of cards that was Sanoff came tumbling down. Now, Fancola, a former vice president of MTN Group, was brought in to lead EOH last July to lead a turnaround of the allegations of mismanagement at the company founded somewhere in 1998. I thought tonight we'd speak to Fancola about the company's latest results and the turnaround plan at EOH, and also speak about Cyprian tech space. Where's the growth coming? Going to come from? And are they in a space of innovation, building their own IP? But first, I'll start with the results. Good evening, Stephen, and thanks for joining us.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right,
good to see you on your show.
Thank you very much for joining us. Now, you've been in the hot seat at EOH for a little over a year now, not touching on today's financial numbers. What has the year been like unraveling the problems at the company?
It's been tough. I mean, clearly, I don't think any one of us is born and bred to really deal with corruption. It's not part of what we do every day. So when you're faced with it, it's quite a big learning curve. It creates some stress. But I think the most important thing is we've managed to get some very competent new board members and new executive onto the team to actually help deal with it. And as you heard today, we've basically closed out on the interview, and we're just now dealing with all the legal requirements through ENS, which fortunately has freed me up to start doing the things I really enjoy doing.
Over the year, you've been at EOH, you've been selling some of your non-core assets to deal with those debt issues. Today, you announced that you're selling a further 1 billion rand of non-core businesses next year as you reorganize the business further. What is the optimal structure in your view, in your look of EOH?
Well, the real issue is, we've ended up with quite a bit of debt burden because we bought a few companies we shouldn't have bought. We put money into Zimbabwe in place, where we haven't been able to get cash out. So we've ended up with a debt burden, which is way too big for...
Hello, Stephen?
I think, a services company should have a debt to EBITDA ratio of somewhere between 1 and 1.5 times, which means we should end up with debt around 1.5 billion maximum, which is basically half of what we've got today.
In your view, what is the optimal structure of EOH? I mean, how many operating assets does the company currently have?
Well, we're quite diverse. And so what we've done is we've now divided it into basically three pillars. You've got the IP pillar, which is four companies. They run quite separately because they do separate things. And basically, they're platform businesses. One of them was the CCS business, which was in the construction industry. We sold 70% to an international partner for an 8.5 times EBITDA. It's a great transaction, which has really already allowed CCS to start accelerating into new markets with new products. And we'll have a look at doing that for the other three businesses. We've got an 8.5 times EBITDA for CCS. The other three businesses have EBITDA north of 300 million. So we think we've got a good asset cover there to generate some cash. We then have the next tech business, which is the new age businesses. Really, these businesses need to be platformed. They've got lots of IP in them, but they haven't been properly digitized, and that's in the smart city, smart utility space, and the knowledge process outsourcing. Then you have the original traditional business, IOCO, which has now got three units. It's got an integration unit, which is the original business, has long-term contracts, real annuity type revenue, quite sticky with clients. You've got the new business, which I call the fourth industrial revolution business, which is the app dev, cloud, data analytics and IoT AI businesses, and then the advisor and consulting businesses. So we've tried to consolidate.
Sorry about that. Hi. Stephen, seems to have lost you for a second. Stephen?
Yeah?
Hi. Sorry, we lost you for a second there.
Okay. We've consolidated them into these units, and we're hoping by the end of the whole consolidation, we would have reduced the number of legal entities by about 70%.
by about 70%. Now, today in your announcement, you struck a deal with banks with regards to settling some of the outstanding debt over the next 2 years. Can you give us some detail of over the next 2 years of EOH life under the terms of this agreement with the lenders?
Yeah, really, what the big issue for me was the original lenders agreement meant that if we ever sold any assets, we had to give the banks 100% of the proceeds, which is fine if you're just purely delivering. But, I mean, what we really need to do is in an IT business, you have to do some investment for growth.
Yeah.
And obviously, we need some cash to sort out some of the issues that we have found. And so, after quite a big negotiation, we've agreed to that we'll keep 25% of any proceeds and 75% will go to delivering. And then we obviously, you know, had to agree a plan with the banks that they're happy which of the assets we're selling and for, you know, what sort of price range. And so it's been quite a complex exercise, but happy to say we agreed with them last week. And we've now got a plan and a runway which we'll deal with them over the next sort of 18 months.
Now, let's go back a bit to the story of EOH. I mean, it has had some remarkable growth. And, I mean, I was looking today, in the 5 years leading to the 2015 peak, shares up over 1,200%, quite ridiculous, really. What do you think really underlined that growth? Did EOH grow too quick, too fast?
No, so there's a few things. I mean, the share price, unfortunately, I don't think has ever reflected true value, largely because it's been a very illiquid share.
Yeah.
So if someone wants to buy a large amount of stock, the share price goes up, and if you want to sell it, it goes down.
Yeah.
So it moves up and down on very small volumes, which isn't very helpful. So I think it got overcooked on the way up and similar effect on the way down. But really, if you have a look at the two main slides in the front of my presentation, there was a few issues that happened. One was, I think they overpaid for businesses, and obviously hindsight is 2020 vision.
Yep.
But they bought them in good economic times, and we were really probably in one of the most difficult economic times that we've got at the moment. So borrowed money to buy businesses that then on generating cash to actually repay the debts. You put pressure on other businesses. And then also we entered in some very complex long-term contracts that I'm not sure we priced well. I am sure that we didn't price them very well. And so we've actually had to pick up a lot of costs on the overruns. And, you know, that's hurt us. And we've had to pay for that. And that's ended up in the debt balance. And so you have to put these two factors together and try and come up with a normalized view, I think.
Mm. I mean, since that peak, I mean, as you say, the shares dramatically come down on the back of what you just said earlier on, describing just how volatile it becomes, that share performance. But that since that peak, primarily on the back of the corruption scandal that led to the loss of the Microsoft contract last year, now you've had a probe and you're charging some of your employees with regards to that contract. But I want to ask whether you think there's something intrinsically wrong with how private sector does business with the public sector. Is there something there that needs to be fixed going forward in the OH business and just in business in general with regards to how they contract with government?
No, I think you're exactly spot on. You know, I call it the taxi effect.
Yeah.
You know, we've got the taxis driving down the yellow lines or going through stop streets or red traffic lights. Everyone thinks it's okay to do it. It's actually not. And this is what we've had to pull back. And in our case, you had a number of entrepreneurial businesses that were run by the entrepreneur. They were small, and so people knew exactly what was going on in their business. As soon as you put those all into one big melting pot, you ended up with not being able to control what was happening in each of the businesses. And if you don't have the governance and controls, you know, things start fraying at the edges. And this is not unusual in any business.
Mm.
I've seen it in all the businesses I work in, but you need to have what I call the second line of defense, which is the compliance and the risk function, and the third line of defense, which is the audit functions. And what happens is if they do their job properly, as these controls fail, they catch them, you retrain, you get it back to what it has to be. And so you have this continual balancing effect. EOH didn't have any of that.
Mm.
They just had the front-end business that was being run, because when you buy the entrepreneurial businesses, they're small, they don't have the wherewithal to put in these governance and control systems. And I think in the listed entities, we need to get into something that's more appropriate around being listed and using, obviously, shareholders' investors' money. And this is what was missing.
I guess this leads to the importance of that board and the new board members that you've put in over the past year that you've been there, that you've seen new board members coming to strengthen that governance.
No, exactly right. It's the same in the executive team. You know, you have to have board members with the requisite skills. So we've got a number of different people on there, whether they're ex-CEOs, whether they've got a risk background. And it's been, you know, quite important to make sure that those skills exist. From people who've been in the industry, who've, you know, been through the mill, as I call it, so that as you're implementing things, they can give you the right advice to do the right things. And I think that's quite important. But also from an executive perspective, you have to get the right executives to, you know, come and implement things that are usual in these types of businesses. We didn't have that before. You know, we had one risk person for 11,000 people. So you can understand why these things flowed at the end.
Makes perfect sense.
And people didn't have the right guidance.
Now, UOH today announcing you blacklisting 50 companies from doing business with you.
We've already done that. I mean, we blacklisted them some time ago, and these are the companies that we've found to be part of this 935 million of looting, as I call it, and so we stopped doing business with them, but more importantly the individuals we were running with.
Now, with regards to that, I saw today that you're renegotiating with Microsoft. Has the cleanup over the past year helped with regards to just that, to almost mending relations with Microsoft, and just how important is having that contract for any tech company operating in South Africa?
It's not critical, but you know, Microsoft, especially with Azure, Office 365, they're quite a big part of the community. Clearly, you don't have to be a licensed reseller. You can buy those licenses from elsewhere, and then you can do all the development on top of it. Nothing precludes us from doing development. As EOH is a company, we use Microsoft software. I pay Microsoft a license fee every month to use it. So the issue here is you want to give an end-to-end service to a customer. So if they want an Azure platform or they want a Office 365, you'd like to provide them with the licenses as well. Now, the issue on becoming an LSP, you would have seen Teto from Altron talking about it took them 6 months.
And
this is because you've got to go through a certification process. They want to see your governance and controls and everything. It's just a normal process. So Dimension Data would have gone through it. DCX would have gone through it. Datacentrics would have gone through it before. And so what we will need to do is we'll need to go back and start from the beginning again. Clearly, we've got the certified engineers because they still work for us, but we'll have to go through their normal processes again to become recertified, and that's going to take time. And obviously, we need to, you know, start those discussions with them and start that process. But my suspicion is it will take most of next year to get through that. From our perspective, it's more a reputational thing than an absolute must in terms of the business and profitability.
Now, with regards to, as we said, as we open up here, it's a very much a market segment as well as much as an insight into EOH. With regards to the future of tech companies such as yourself, I mean, there's always been this question of whether South African tech companies, the majors anyway, such as EOH, are they companies that innovate or implementers of what global tech giants do? Or are you, cynically, some people call our tech industry primarily like plumbers, really? Or how do you view the tech space as a whole in South Africa?
That's a very interesting analogy.
Yeah.
In the past, you would be right. That's really what we did, is we took international technology and we would implement it in South Africa. But, you know, as this has become more open sourced, more plug and play, if I can put it, the whole development on top of these softwares has become more key. So the implementation of these core systems, in a way, that they are flexible and modular and you are able to develop on top of them, has become more important. So no longer is your whole stack just just Microsoft or IBM or HP. You use a number of different technologies, and the trick is getting them all to talk to each other.
Mm.
And that's really where companies like ourselves come in.
Mm.
So if you have a look at that, when I talk about our OCO, the ICT business, and you've got those three pillars, you've got the systems integrator, which is what you call the plumber. It's a little bit more than that, but
yeah,
that's what it used to be. And then you've got the solutions business and the advisory and consulting businesses. And the solutions business is now more this new age fourth industrial revolution, where you're trying to make these bits all work together, trying to make it modular, trying to make it agile and flexible. And that's real high-end consulting. And then you get into the consulting and advisory businesses, which are now almost strategy businesses, saying, okay, this is what your assets are, these are your customers, this is what you can do, this is how much cost you can take out if you digitize or automate these bits, and if you, these are the different software providers, these are the, you know, the problems with them, these are the advantages with them, if you do it this way, it works that way. And then you can strategize with the C-suite to then decide, okay, what are our choices and then how do we implement them? And then you can go through the implementation. So it's all building blocks. I call it sort of 1.0, 2.0, and 3.0 in a way. And if you've got that stack, you're obviously very helpful to a customer, because these skills aren't a dime a dozen.
Yeah.
And really, the high-end skills want to work in a tech company rather than in an industry, because if you get in the industry, you get very narrowly focused. If you work for a tech company, you get much more opportunity to work across industries and come up with better solutions.
I mean, lastly, for a tech company such as EOH, I mean, over the next year or two, once you get over the reorganization of the business, where do you see real growth coming through for EOH and for the sector as a whole?
Yeah, listen, we obviously quite correlated to the economy, because in a bad economy, people are really just doing the important replacement and upgrades. In the good economy, they start spending on innovation and change and trying to take costs out of their system. So, you know, the more they spend, the better we do, and the less they spend, the more we have to manage ourselves. Fortunately, the tech world is quite a flexible workforce.
Yep.
So you do use a lot of contractors, so you have the ability to flex up and flex down. But really where we see the growth is going to be largely in the hyperscale move, or the move to on-prem data storage and application services to cloud-based application services and storage. And that's quite a big move over the next 3 or 4 years. And obviously, we're very well placed to do that. And then clearly, once you're in the cloud, your ability to create flexible applications and microservices on top of that is just way enhanced from having mainframes on premise, like a lot of companies have to do. And so that's a very exciting development that will happen over the next 4 or 5 years. And obviously, we've organized ourselves to get involved in that.
And thank you, and that was my discussion with Stephen Van Coller, the CEO.